This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
It's 3:34 on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. With Derek Johnson, I'm Nick Schwert. RCST going until 5:45 tonight. We'll talk to Matt Galloway at 4 o'clock. The voice of the Jayhawks, Brian Haney, at 5 o'clock. But right now, let's welcome on our good buddy, former Kansas running back, Orange Bowl champion, Brandon McAnderson. BMAC, I hear every single week that a team has a bye week, every coach across America says it, you know, it's perfect time for a bye week. Doesn't matter if it's in week 3, week 4, week 11. It's always the perfect time for this team to have a week off. You've been through it. I want to know, when is actually, unequivocally, the best time to have a bye week?
I would say that that's a true statement, that there's always a good time because of rest and then getting an opportunity to refocus on fundamentals. So it is always a good time because during the season, most of your practice is associated with game planning. So it's one time where you can get some rest for your body, and then mentally, physically, you can get into some muscle memory stuff in terms of doing your job the way you're supposed to. So there is always a good time. I always liked that our bye week was 1 week before conference play. And when we got good, we had some later on in the season because we were playing on Thanksgiving. But bye weeks were always good.
All right, so KU's coming off their bye week, 1 week into conference play. You've paid close attention to this team. What kinds of things, you know, using your experience as a guideline, what kinds of things were they working on in that bye week as they head into week 2 of Big 12 play?
I bet their practices were really competitive, and I bet that they were really trying to see who can play. Because a lot of it is, to me, this is the conclusion I've come to, that a lot of what we're seeing is Kansas is playing the people that practice better, the people that learn better, and that's what most teams do. I'm just not certain that Kansas has that luxury in terms of if it gets to the point where we need to put out our most talented player, we need to do it. And I keep going back to Toby that's been playing right tackle just because he's been a big, big difference maker in terms of what they're doing up front. And the only thing that I could think of is maybe he wasn't practicing well. Maybe it wasn't coming down mentally. But, you know, when thrust into action, I mean, he has been a huge impact player. So I think that those practices were really competitive, and I bet they got something out of them and learned about who was there and what type of players they're going to be moving forward.
I mean, we've seen it already with Khalil Herbert not really playing much the first couple of weeks, and Doug Meacham and David Beatty kind of came out and said, you know, we challenged him because he wasn't playing. We challenged him in practice, like, hey, man, like, we know you're better than this. You need to go out there and prove it in practice. He did, and then he had a historical performance against West Virginia 2 weeks ago. A lot of people are asking the same about Daylon Charlotte because he's a guy who we heard all about in the offseason. We haven't really seen him yet. Now, I think that there's a case to be made that that's not really what we should be concerning ourselves with because there have been plenty of receivers that are showcasing they're more than capable of playing in the Big 12, and I don't know how much one receiver, regardless of how good he is, comes in and changes things for KU, but I think you're absolutely seeing that with the theme of this team, and I guess we're just to the point now where, okay, you're playing good in practice, that's why you're playing in these games. Well, now you need to start playing good in these games so you can start being in them in these late-game situations.
Right, and if you're a fan, this is probably actually a good sign. I mean, because Coach Beatty is, you know, I don't know how much pressure he feels, but when you're losing, you're always feeling some sort of pressure. I think it's a good sign that he's sticking to the principles of the program and wanting those players to earn an opportunity as opposed to giving it to them, and he's doing that regardless of the optics. So that could honestly be seen as a good thing, and it is a good thing. And it's probably where they're moving more toward, you know, maybe the guy that practiced better starts, and then the guy that we think can be a better player will get an opportunity, and if he takes advantage, he plays. If he doesn't, we move on. I don't have a problem with that. I think it's showing that they are building the program the right way and not trying to skip steps, which is something that he said often. And I think the way the roster has shaken out, is kind of proof of that. You didn't mention guys like Isaiah Bean or Kyle Mayberry, guys that came in here with big expectations and played a little bit as freshmen, and guys that really haven't been present from a production standpoint early in the season.
And I've talked about that several times over the past couple of years, about building it the right way despite the pressure to produce results right now. And I wonder how much that changes from year to year. Like, year number one, expectations were so low that I don't think there was a ton of pressure to maybe we cut a corner right here that'll give us results in the here and now, but may kind of hinder us down the road. But as you are in year number three, I wonder if that pressure intensifies at all. Clearly, the proof is that David Beatty hasn't wilted under that pressure. He hasn't kind of changed his philosophy or his mindset, but I wonder how that compares to how he was feeling in year one or two.
Well, I mean, just because we have a recent example we can use, it was Charlie Weiss, who was trying to use a lot of quick fixes with JUCO players and, you know, incoming transfers, and he got in front of the media and told us how great they were, and they weren't great. You know, so, I mean, we've seen the other side of it. So, you know, this isn't about a fan being patient. It's really about trusting the program and trusting the coach and allowing them to do what they are paid to do. And I think that's what Kansas football fans have to do. They have to allow this man to do the job he was brought in to do and trust the principals. And we really don't have another choice or another option, or we'll be able to find a guy that will want to be here the way this guy has. And hopefully we'll continue to pull coaching talent like with Meacham.
Well, you mentioned Meacham, and I think that's an interesting point because he comes in with this resume of just unbelievable success in his 3 years at TCU. He turns them in from one of the bottom offenses in the country to one of the best offenses in the country, and that's what he's clearly trying to do here at Kansas. And we've seen strides being made, and you go back to that game 2 weeks ago, all of a sudden there's this really potent rushing attack that we haven't seen at all over the past couple of years with Khalil Herbert, fourth best rushing performance in program history. When you have a game like that, of course, he's not going to do that every single time out. But for an offense that is predicated upon spreading the field and throwing the ball and getting those big chunk plays, how does having a game from Khalil Herbert perhaps change your mindset on how you attack defenses on a weekly basis?
I don't think it does. And I do think that if you really looked at the signs of what's happening with Kansas's offense, you can see that he's already having an impact on the program. They are much further along than they were last year at this time. The second thing is, I don't think you really go into a game thinking that we're going to do this more than we do that, meaning run or pass. I think from a philosophical standpoint, you may say we're going to spread the field and pass and open up opportunities in the run game. But in a given game, the philosophy is not going to outrank the game plan. The game plan is going to be, and when you're on offense, you're trying to find things that you do well, and it could be anything. Because if you don't have, because a lot of offense is like, it's like boxing in a way. It's about counterpunching. And you can't set up counterpunches unless you have powerful primary punches. So Kansas right now is trying to find things that they are good at. Because if they can't find things that they're good at, trick plays don't work. Misdirection doesn't work. Play action doesn't work. None of that works. They can't take advantage of their speed, their skill player. So I think they're just looking to establish being good at something. And running the football the way they did their previous game, they'll build on that because they found something that they can do. They did it so well that they have the fourth leading rusher in program history, and they racked up almost 400 yards rushing. So, I mean, it's something that they know, okay, now we can do this. So let's try to make sure that we can build, take another step.
Talking to Brandon McAnderson here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Offensively, I said earlier in the week, and I'm sticking by it at this point, that we try to find all of these different fixes and these different things that can help improve week by week, game by game. But you got 7 interceptions through 4 games, and you are at amongst the bottom of the country in turnover margin. Like, that to me, easier said than done, I understand that, but that to me has to be the number one team thing this team is looking at as far as what's the quickest way we can start seeing results on Saturdays. You've got to take care of the ball. You've got to start forcing turnovers defensively.
Yes, they've got to start forcing turnovers. I don't think they should be super concerned about the interceptions that he's thrown. I mean, other than one, I don't think there was any really bad interceptions, and in every game they've been down. So they're trying to throw to get back in it. So those are understandable. But forcing turnovers has got to be a part of the equation. And it's not something that we've seen a lot of to start the season. But they've got to get that turnover margin flipped. You know, you don't want interceptions, but if you're behind, you got to throw the ball. And that, you know, and mistakes happen. So I get that. But you're right. Turnovers has got to be where it comes from, whether it be from the D-line or from a DB breaking on a ball, you know, stripping a ball carrier, getting on to them early. But those things have got to start happening.
Well, it just seems like it's fixable. Like, we can point to problems that aren't fixable. If you have a problem with the personnel. You just don't think they're athletic enough. You just don't think they're good enough. You don't think there's enough depth at this position or that position. Like, that's a different conversation. But if we're talking about taking care of the ball, better communication between the quarterback and the wide receivers, if we're talking about better assignment, being more sound defensively, those are all things that are fixable. And I feel like when you look at this turnover margin for KU, like, that is a fixable problem.
Absolutely. And it's just something they have to be good at. Because regardless of how we feel about how much more talented Kansas is, which they are, they still have the smallest room. They still have the smallest margin for error in the conference. They don't have the opportunity to make mistakes and recover from them. They just don't. They have to limit penalties. They have to limit turnovers. They have to force turnovers. And that has to be a part of the equation in every game. And this is not something that these players and this coaching staff don't know. But it is something that they need to fix, and it's something that's fixable. So, I mean, you're right. That's something that needs to be focused on and probably was, you know, with some turnover circuits in practice and whatnot during the bye week.
What's your prediction for this game? I know Texas Tech's a big favorite, but maybe a little better than we thought they would be before the season. KU coming off the bye. Is this a game that they should conceivably be in down the stretch?
I guess my concern is the way that they're able to spread the field and the pace that they play with. I'm honestly concerned because we've seen what kind of speed they have at those positions from what they did to Kansas last year. A better Kansas defense, or about the same actually, because this was before Mike Leach started playing full time. About the same time he started playing full time. So, I mean, it's to me, it looks like it's going to be a similar situation. I think the difference will be I think our offense will continue to stabilize, and I do think Kansas is going to be significantly better at home this season. And it's an 11 a.m. game, and that's got to be in the favorite game. Like I said, they've got to take advantage of every single thing. So I do like their chances to hang in there and hopefully limit some turnovers, make some turnovers, and make some plays in the passing game because we've seen what the DBs haven't been able to do. I'd like to see what the D-line can do if they step it up and help those guys out a little bit.
B-Mac, you're on a bit of a heater right now. You're 6-8 over your last 2 weeks, which has significantly increased your season total. You are now 12-20-1 on the season in your weekend football picks. How are you feeling this weekend?
I'm feeling like a prophet. Yeah, I mean, what else am I supposed to feel like?
Right, exactly. Like I said a couple of weeks ago, if you're going to pick games, you either want to be really good or really bad. The last thing you want to be is 500 because anybody can do that. What you're doing is very, very hard to duplicate or replicate. So I just hope that either you continue to go on this heater or you get ice cold. But just don't be a 500. Don't be average. That's the last thing I want from you.
I'm trying to be Jeff Fisher, St. Louis Rams. I want to be right in the middle.
8-8, Jeff Fisher. All right, here we go. First game, the only ranked matchup of the weekend comes in the Big 12, West Virginia on the road in Fort Worth, taking on TCU, number 23 versus number 8. Horned Frogs, 13-point favorites.
I'm going to say that they will not cover, and I don't really have a reason.
You don't have a reason? I don't need reasons, okay? I just need winners or losers. I don't care about your reasons. That's perfectly fine.
Cool. But you're going to get my reasons when I want them to come out.
That's fine. No, yeah, that's perfectly acceptable. Give me the reason with 2 minutes to go in the fourth quarter and the outcome is no longer in doubt. That's when I want your reasons from you. All right. Miami, 3-point favorites on the road against Florida State.
Haven't seen either team play. Florida State's quarterback's hurt, but they have a good defense. I'm going to go with Florida State.
Is that a question? Florida State question mark? I'll write that down. Uncertain about Florida State. Stanford, 4-point favorites on the road against Utah, who is ranked 20th in the country.
You know what? I couldn't care less. I mean, that's the only explanation.
I don't care either. I don't care about this game. All right.
Utah.
Finally, KU, Texas Tech, the Red Raiders, 16.5-point favorites.
Will not cover.
I like that. Stay true to who you are. All right, let's go to the NFL. Carolina at Detroit. Lions, 2.5-point favorites.
Will cover.
You got the Lions covering 2.5? All right, Seattle.
I like that.
Seattle against the Rams. Rams, 1.5-point favorites.
Ooh, I'll take the Rams.
Green Bay at Dallas. The Cowboys are 2-point favorites.
I'm gonna take Green Bay. The desperation for Dallas is gonna be new, and they will know how to handle it.
And the Chiefs on Sunday Night Football the number one team in football, unequivocally, inarguable, just a fact at this
point.
The
Oakland Raiders.
And they are, and the 2-2 Oakland Raiders, right. The Chiefs are hosting the Texans, and Kansas City just a one-point favorite. Excuse me, not hosting, on the road in Houston. My apologies.
On the road in Houston, and they're a one-point favorite?
Yeah, the Chiefs are.
Ooh.
You going to take the home dog?
They'll cover because they're just likely to win games. And I will say this about the Chiefs. They've been one of the more fun teams to watch this year.
Wait a minute. You just said they're likely to win games, like, almost as if it's a dig on the team. Like, they're just the only thing they're good at is winning.
What I mean is, like, they'll just find, smaller Andy Reid is just going to call some unique, neat play, or, you know, the Chiefs defense is going to look awful, and then somehow Justin Houston will get a sack. They are the best at just figuring it out. So I think with a one-point spread, they'll figure it out.
I take that as a compliment. I hope you know that.
Yeah, it doesn't work in the playoffs, but it's a good idea. It's a good way to start.
Always had to throw in a dig there at the end for his 2-2 Raiders, who are without their quarterback, Derek Carr, and has the wide receiver with perhaps the worst hands that I've ever seen with an elite skill set other than that in Amari Cooper. What's he got, like 12 drops through four games this year? Pretty good.
He makes me want to literally throw up. So, I'm with you 100%. Can't stand it.
Brandon McAnderson, former Kansas running back, Orange Bowl champion, joins us every Friday. Appreciate the time, man.
Yes, sir.
All righty, that's BMAC. I'm Nick Schwert with Derek Johnson. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Four o'clock hour is here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. I am Nick Schwert with Derek Johnson. We now welcome into the studio, as we do every Friday at 4, our good friend from the Topeka Capital Journal fame, Matt Galloway, joins us once again.
New haircut guy, the awesome nickname that you've come up with for me.
Well, you got
because
a new haircut.
I got a haircut a week and a half ago.
We should start calling you New Haircut Guy.
That's great. I'm just going to change my Twitter handle to New Haircut Guy.
That would actually be way better for your brand.
Yeah?
Yeah, for sure. They'd say, wait a minute. People would say, who's this new haircut guy reporting KU News? That's different.
I love that Nick says all of this from under a black hat.
What's your point?
My point is you're patronizing me about my haircut.
Why do you think I'm patronizing you?
Because you're just nobody zones in on you gotta Derek, come on. Nobody zones in on a haircut this much unless they're being
every single time that somebody in this office gets a haircut, I pride myself on the fact that I will notice it within 48 hours.
Okay.
I'm not one of those guys who's like, you're going to get a new haircut, and I'm not going to bring it up immediately.
Yeah.
So if I notice that fresh hairline, I'm going to bring it up. I noticed it with you, and then you immediately, for some reason, jump to the fact that I'm making fun of you because of it.
That's just how I'm wired, dude. That's just how I operate.
That's not how I operate. I operate this is a no patronizing zone.
Okay.
It's a no flex zone, and it's a no patronizing zone.
Mm-hmm.
That's patronizing. That is how you patronize somebody. Hey, so I've kind of went back and forth, and I've totally hedged my bets with this college basketball scandal stuff. Then last week, like everybody else, this is the tip of the iceberg. There's going to be so much stuff coming out. It's going to wreck college basketball. Coaches getting fired. Wins being vacated. Postseason bans. All this stuff. And then time passes, and it kind of slows down a little bit. You take a step back and you wonder, you know, if they came out and held this press conference, maybe it's because they ran out of stuff to report. They ran out of investigations. Because as Chris Stone put up a piece on FanSided, who's been on the show several times, he reported yesterday talking to an attorney who's worked with the FBI, you don't hold press conferences at the beginning of an investigation. You don't say, hey, just in case you guys were wondering, we're going to be investigating all you guys. So just wanted to give you a heads up.
These FBI press conferences always tend to have some kind of certain flair to them. And I think the reason why people might have thought that there might be more bang, 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 bang type of fallout from this is because the phrase is tip of the iceberg and we have your playbook were used.
Right.
That's why people thought this is more of a long-term thing. My whole thought process about this at the time was this was on the heels of 3 years of investigation and they produced four assistant coaches. Essentially, some other people, a very prominent Adidas rep, which is I think the most intriguing part about it, but 3 years of investigation produced four assistant coaches. I think that this is not over. I think we haven't seen the last of this. I think if it, at the very least, this is going to just out of fear of this being a criminal activity now, put the fear of God kind of into some of these assistant coaches at some of these locations. But I do think it's going to probably here moving forward be at a glacial pace.
Well, think about it like this. Like if you wanted to write some big introspective long form piece on Bill Self, right? And you go down to Oklahoma and you're interviewing his family members, his parents, you're interviewing high school teammates, and you're telling your boss this is gonna be a great piece. It's gonna be so in depth. Nobody's gonna have done anything like this before. And all of a sudden, 6 months pass, 9 months pass, and what's your boss telling you? He's saying,
where is it?
Where is it? Like, well, it's not, I don't have everything yet. And he's gonna say, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Print what you have. I'm sure it's going to be fine. I would imagine it's sort of that kind of thing going on with the FBI because when they find out that they're going to be investigating college basketball coaches and then you start seeing the stuff that they're coming up with, like what kinds of crimes are you getting these guys for? Oh, honest services fraud. I would imagine the higher-ups at the FBI are going, wrap this up because we have bigger things to worry about. You've been on this for 3 years, so you need to start producing arrests. And what they came up with or 10 arrests, and as you mentioned, four of them being college basketball coaches, they present it with that press conference like, look at how good we're doing.
Yeah.
But I wonder how they analyze it from the flip side. I wonder if the FBI is just like embarrassed that they spent 2-3 years on this and this is all they've come up with so far.
I think just the way that everybody reacted, I don't think the FBI would be embarrassed. I think everybody thinks that that's a sports fan that thinks the FBI did what the NCAA couldn't do. And at the very least, I think that that's something that the FBI can hang its hat on. My only issue with that is I tend to agree with you. I think that they alerted everybody that this is going on. So immediately everybody's going to start going into CYA mode, to use an acronym. And I don't think you do that unless you think you have everything in hand. Like I think if they thought some of these guys could have led them to other bigger fish out there, I think that they would have held off on the big flashy press conference and the arrests and all of that. I think the fact that they went forward with what they have, I think that's what they have for now. And maybe throughout the process of this, now that some of these guys are arrested, they'll talk and they'll lead the investigators onto different avenues. But as of right now, I just think that this is going to kind of grind and do as close to a halt as it can get without it actually being a halt.
Because think about it. Just think about it. Realistically, let's just use one of these coaches. Let's say Tony Bland, one of the four assistants who was arrested for USC. He's talking to investigators, and they're saying, hey, man, if you want this to go away, you're going to have to start giving us some names. And he says, okay, well, Coach X at Roast Beef State, he was paying this kid, you know, $250,000. Coach Y at, you know, Turkey Sandwich University was paying this kid $50,000.
The rivals.
All right, well, how are we going to prove that? Because you can't get the wiretaps anymore. It's already happened. You can't get guys in rooms because it's already happened.
Yeah.
And that's why it was a long, drawn-out investigation. They had to go in, infiltrate, then find stuff out now. It's too late to do any of that kind of stuff. And these assistant coaches are most certainly not going to have hard evidence on file that's going to implicate anybody else at any other school. So I don't know how it's going to work.
I will say the only thing that I could think would be we live in the age of text messages, and if there's text messages tied directly to some of these phone numbers that they could just say, hey, you want to get me off? I will hand you the cell phone with 125 text messages with coaches and recruits across the country and shoe reps setting up payments and things like that, and I will walk free and I will live a new life. Although you'd never coach basketball again, I'm sure he would find a nice house with a white picket fence somewhere in Utah that he could live for the rest of his life. But it's very intriguing. I'll admit I'm not a big legal person. I'm not exactly familiar with the Travel Act of 1939 or whatever it is that some of these individuals have been charged with, but it's definitely intriguing and it's something to brush up on and keep an eye on. I just don't think it's something that college basketball fans anywhere should be losing any sleep over unless you're at one of these like half dozen programs.
I wonder how much coaches across the country like explicitly know exactly what's going on at other schools. You know, like I wonder if they're like Tony, let's use Chuck Person, Auburn.
Yeah.
I wonder if he knew. I wonder how much he knows about stuff that's going on at other Under Armour schools. Mm-hmm. I wonder if he's talking to an Under Armour rep and he's saying, hey, the Under Armour rep's telling him, hey, we're sending this kid to another Under Armour school, or they're paying him more than you guys are.
My only thing about this is everybody has always said, everybody does it, and it's the worst-kept secret in college basketball. I have a hard time believing that because if you're a rival school and you know you have to play Team X and you know that one of the highest-paid or one of the recruits is a highly-paid individual on that team, you're going to whistleblow that situation unless you yourself are also guilty of that and you're worried about the whole house of cards just falling down on top of you, I guess.
And that's the thing, like, and even to your point, let's just say there was just one school, who wasn't cheating and everybody else in the country was. Wouldn't it behoove that one school to say, screw this, why would I? It'd be like him being in baseball and be the only guy not taking steroids.
Yeah.
Why would you not ride out the other guys? Because you're just going to sit there and say, well, we're doing it the right way. We're getting thumped every year, but we're doing it the right way, and I have pride. At least I'll get to take that home with me.
I suppose it would just be if you were leery of being labeled a snitch. We've seen sometimes retaliation against whistleblowers has been worse for their careers in other industries than it has been for the people that have had the whistle blown on them.
But if you're a good coach, if you're a college basketball coach and you're winning and you're doing it the right way, then
yeah.
You keep winning, and sure. And then on top of that, right. They'll say, okay, well, at least we know he wins. Oh, yeah, and by the way, he's going to run a clean program.
And to your point, that's why I'm very skeptical of the folks that say everybody does this. It's the worst kept secret. I think it was a problem that was beyond – it had gotten out of hand that the NCAA had not – NCAA couldn't contain this anymore. But I don't think it was something, an epidemic that was just rampant across every conference in the country – just, you know, left and right going on. I could be proven wrong. I tend to think that this is a little bit bigger of a problem than people thought maybe a month ago and a little bit less of a problem than people thought a week ago or even now.
We're talking to Matt Galloway here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. I've kind of come to the point that I'm more interested in what comes of the shoe companies than what comes of these universities, because think about it logistically. If you are Adidas, if you're Nike, if you're Under Armour, you can stand to make a lot more money off these kids than the schools can, right? Because if you get this kid, if you're a Nike rep and you say, okay, well, I found this kid, he's 17 years old and I think he's going to be the future.
Yeah.
You send him to a Nike school. Okay, that Nike school gets to make money off of him for 1 year, maybe two. And then after that, sure, there, I guess, are residual impacts that it can have on your program from him just being tied to you. But if you're Nike, you make money, you spend some money on him right now, and then he signs a $100 million deal with you when he's in the NBA and then goes on to be a 10-time All-Star, you make boatloads of cash, way more than a school could possibly make in 1 year. And, oh, and by the way, when everybody in college is buying those jerseys with his number and no name on the back, well, yeah, the school's making money off that, but the brand who's producing those jerseys is making a lot more.
I think the way people would look at it is kind of like an upfront loan where the athlete says, okay, I'll sign with you eventually, and I'll go to the school you want me to with the shoe brand and all of that you want me to kind of build my legacy with your brand. Right now, you give my family X amount of dollars, and then I'll repay you in making you money down the line. I think that's the way that it's kind of looked at as maybe an upfront loan with heavy interest that you don't necessarily have to pay back.
Yeah, I definitely don't think it's happening everywhere for a variety of reasons. I don't think every coach wants to do it. And I bet you there are a lot of kids out there who don't want to be told what to do. Yeah. Right? There are a lot of kids out there who want to say, hey, this all sounds great, but you're not going to tell me where to go to school.
And my biggest issue with all this is if it's just as easy as dumping a plate of money in a kid's lap, why do you need to bother with things like some of the remarkable facilities we've seen spring up around the country,
right?
Some of the over-the-top you know, wooing that some of these schools do of recruits in the public eye. Why do coaches need to get one hour of sleep because they flew across the country to watch a kid's game in California the day before they have their own game? Like, why do they have to do all that if it's as simple as I'm going to dump the biggest plate of money on your lap? I think that coaches who aren't doing that kind of stuff and still landing biggest recruits should be the ones getting the red flags. But the ones who, like I said, get like 10 hours of sleep a week because they're killing themselves going across the country watching these kids, and universities are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on facilities and residence halls and all of that other stuff. I mean, to me, why would you do that if it were just that easy?
It's a really good point, because when we talk about college coaches and why they would ever want to make the jump to the NBA or why they'd ever want to retire, often the thing that comes up is they don't want to deal with recruiting anymore. Yeah. Because it is like a separate full-time job, having to recruit and appease these kids and meet their parents and go and, like you said, fly across the country and go to games for one night, and then you're flying back to coach your game the next night. Like
these horribly played AAU or high school, right? Games that just, set basketball back a decade or two. I mean, that you go and watch, and then you have to fly back and coach a game the next day. I don't think it's that simple. I don't think it's as simple as people are making it out to be.
Well, Louisville's, I think, a perfect example, because they are not an elite basketball program, but they're probably in that next tier, that second tier, mm-hmm. behind the Blue Bloods. And when you look at the recruiting rankings that they're bringing in on given years, yeah, they're amongst some of the best in the country, but being amongst the best and being the best are two different things. Like Kansas, Kentucky, North Carolina, Duke, Arizona, they are bringing in the best recruiting classes every year. If you go back over the past 6-7 years, Louisville's consistently ranked like amongst that next tier with mm-hmm. Indiana and Florida. And I'm sitting here thinking, you were going to cheat that brazenly to be like amongst the 7th or 8th best recruiting classes in the country, which I think speaks to the bigger picture here, which is programs like Louisville probably felt like, hey, we don't want to be a second-rate basketball program. We want to be mentioned amongst the Blue Bloods. What do we have to do to do it?
Yeah. And not to disparage their past, but like if they weren't to do those extra things to sweeten the pot against the NCAA rules, would they have been a Kansas State in terms of recruiting? Would they have been a Texas Tech in terms of recruiting? We don't know. Did that help them reach that level that they would have not made, you know, otherwise? I almost think that it's a situation where it was worth it to them until you get caught, obviously now it was very much not worth it.
Are we going to turn this into a conversation we've had like 5 times? Like, oh, now you got caught, so now it's a situation, because
yeah.
we can have some more ban the apology talk.
It's different if you get caught by the NCAA. I just think the biggest thing to come out of this is I think everybody is just stunned that this is now and that maybe they shouldn't be. I mean, it's tax-free income that they're sending these kids, but like that the FBI and other federal agencies are getting involved. I think that's as big of a game changer as anything, because nobody wants to go to jail over this stuff.
He's Matt Galloway. I'm Nick Schwert. This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. We got a Zaxby's giveaway coming up in our next segment. But coming up next, we've got your Friday news break. It's the end of an era on One Online Messenger.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
20 till 5 on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. With Derek Johnson, I myself am Nick Schwert, and we are joined in studio by the illustrious Matt Galloway of the Topeka Capital Journal. It's a Friday, it's 4:42, so it's time for your weekly movie review with Matt Galloway.
Every week that puts a smile on my face.
Matt, your reputation
uh-huh.
is at stake with this movie review today.
I was going to ask you to tell the listeners what you told me as you briskly walked away from the studio for a moment earlier.
I very nonchalantly.
Dropping
as I exited
a bombshell on me.
I exited the studio and just turned around and said, Your reputation is on the line.
No
with
big
this
deal.
Review.
Your reputation's on the line with this review, though.
Well, what did you give Old School last week?
5.5.
Yeah, it's atrocious. 5.5. Absolutely atrocious. Now, you know, here's the problem with
many
that.
Many people are saying that it was the best review.
Oh, many are?
Many people.
The problem with that is now every time I watch Old School, I'm going to be thinking, like, am I a fan of a terrible movie and I just have terrible taste? You've not ruined it, but you've certainly dampened my enjoyment of that movie. Hope you're happy.
I'm not happy. I'm devastated.
Yes, you are.
That's
exactly what you wanted. Because you came in and you knew what you were going to give that review, and you knew that I was going to have a problem with it. And I think you take a little solace in that.
I don't at all.
I
want to make everybody happy.
Just bringing me
back
down to earth. No. You are a people pleaser. Okay.
Fight Club.
On the docket. Fight Club. Okay, first thing, just to make sure you watched it. What's the first rule about Fight Club?
We have to end the review now.
Oh my gosh, you didn't watch it, did you?
No, we can't talk about it.
Oh, so, look at that.
Goodbye, everybody.
Pulled the fast one off.
Released in 1999, directed by the great David Fincher, perhaps the most underrated movie director of our time. Also directed Seven.
Oh, really? Okay.
Have we?
Brad Pitt. Yeah,
we have. We watched that, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so.
What's in the box?
Have you seen Panic Room?
No.
Okay, it doesn't matter, but he's directed a lot of stuff. And he directed this one, released in 1999. The five-word synopsis of Fight Club is?
Schizophrenic insomniac inadvertently starts cult. Pretty accurate?
Pretty accurate. That's
pretty
actually,
accurate.
That's actually
now,
really good.
I understand I don't want to get a bunch of angry calls. Multiple personality disorder is the more accurate term, and schizophrenic might not be as accurate. But that takes up three words, and that would have been much more difficult for me to fit into my five-word synopsis.
That's fair enough.
So this is based on a 1996 novel of the same name.
Which is a very good read if you haven't read it. It's one of like six books I've read.
I haven't. It stars Brad Pitt as Tyler Durden, Edward Norton as the narrator, and really the only other main character is Marla Singer, played by Helena Bonham Carter. I don't think I've ever seen her in anything else.
She's been in she always plays a gothic chick in every movie she's in.
Yeah.
She always plays that same character, like crazy hair, like sort of out there, weird, frenetic type of character.
Right.
Same character.
And she nailed it. I mean, she did a great job. Uh-huh. I thought the acting in this film was absolutely tremendous. I thought all of these, I mean, there weren't many main characters, and it was a 2.5 hour long film, but they managed to keep my interest the entire way across. And so what I need to talk about first before we get into the plot really is this movie was marketed horribly. And I remember the marketing because it was marketed as a fight film, and it was marketed as Fight Club plays a huge central role in this film. And it does briefly, but they're not fighting for that long. Really, this is more of a dark comedy slash coming of age type picture. I actually looked into it a little bit more, and the studio hated this film after it. Fox hated this film. Rupert Murdoch hated this film. And they wanted to market it as a Brad Pitt kind of they were all over the place at the time.
They almost didn't get this movie released because they had to cut a ton of stuff just to get the R rating. Because eventually, at first, the MPAA was like, dude, this is NC-17. This is really bad. So they had to cut a ton of stuff. And yes, that's part of the reason why Fox was not very happy with it.
Yeah, and so basically the film follows around Edward Norton's character, the narrator. He is a white-collar guy. He's a traveling automobile recall specialist who has insomnia, and he's really not happy with his life. And one day he goes to his doctor, and he's like, give me something, I feel terrible. And he said, you want to feel terrible, you should go to the testicular cancer meetup group. And so he goes, and he gets addicted to going to these meetup groups where they all actually listen. I think one of the lines is, everywhere else, people are just quiet and waiting for their chance to turn. But at these meetup or talk and these meetup places, they actually listen to you because they think you're about to die.
Mm-hmm.
So Marla Singer's character comes in and just ruins it because she's, reminding him of how scummy a thing he's doing.
She's doing the same thing, though.
Yeah. And it sets off a chain of events where eventually on a plane, he meets Brad Pitt's character, who is almost like the exact antithesis of Edward Norton's character.
And
it's
by
like
the
a
way,
yin-yang,
right,
almost.
Right. Because Edward Norton is this guy that is all substance, or excuse me, is all superficial, has no substance. Mm-hmm. And Tyler Durden is the polar opposite to that.
Right.
Funny thing about that is when you're finally introduced to Tyler Durden, he's actually already been in the movie four different times at that point because the director, David Fincher, puts him in one frame four different times throughout the movie. There's a scene where he's at the copier. They show him for one frame, and he goes away. There's a scene where he's watching TV. He's in the commercial for 1 second, goes mm-hmm. away. They do that four different times.
The only time I noticed that was when he was, I think, on one of those airport things that takes you stand on it, and it takes
yes.
you across, and he's passing, and they actually like show him passing. So I didn't notice the other times, but this is
very
this
subliminal.
Is a lot,
yes.
There are a lot. This came out around the time of Sixth Sense. That it comes, it parallels that movie kind of crazily to me because it's a movie you have to rewatch. You have to go back and watch it again and see what did you miss, and kind of like The Usual Suspects again in that regard.
Yeah, it is, because there are so many different little subliminal messages that once you understand exactly what's happening, you do. You immediately know, oh my gosh, I missed so much in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, you watch it the first time, and it's fulfilling, but then you realize, I probably caught 60% of this movie.
And I would like to watch it again. I think that that might have an effect on my rating. I think that the reason I said what I said earlier about it was because I wasn't expecting this movie to become such a I expected it to just be about fighting and Fight Club, which is how it was marketed. I read a piece of trivia when I was watching this that said that the director was actually furious that the biggest ad buys for this film were on WWE programming and UFC programming because they were marketing it as like an underground
right.
fight movie. And that's really just not what it's about.
Not
it's
at
about
all. It's about
starting up this cult that's like anti-materialistic, anti-corporations.
Anti-consumerism.
Yeah, and this man's internal struggle with himself and what he wants to be.
And that theme of like anti-consumerism is prevalent throughout like the entire movie. I think the funniest part about it is when he meets Tyler Durden, and he says, or Tyler Durden tells him, I make and sell soap, the yardstick of civilization. That is a Sigmund Freud. That is an actual philosophy of his. Is like back in the day, like you could tell who was where in civilization by how clean they were.
Yeah.
And what's so funny about Tyler Durden is he makes and sells soap, yet he lives a life of squalor.
Yeah.
Like it's the dirtiest, filthiest, disgusting life you could ever imagine.
And another great thing that you see is very early on, they have the same briefcase, and you go back and you realize, oh, well, that might have been signaling something that happens later on in the film. It's all these little hints that like happen in The Sixth Sense,
uh-huh.
like, foreshadowing. And as far as the big twist goes, I ended up having, I knew that there was a twist in this movie. I didn't,
you saw it coming in Usual Suspects.
Yeah. I didn't see it coming as much here, although the trivia, unfortunately, a trivia bubble popped up and spoiled it.
Were you watching it on like AMC or something?
I was watching it on Amazon, which has little trivia things that
how did it spoil
up.
It?
Because it said, like, notice how when the phone rings, the sounds of them making love stops when he goes to answer the phone or something like that. When Edward
That's
Norton's character...
That,
and it's like...
You should get your money back.
I should.
Yeah. Amazon, you paid for that movie and they ruined it for you.
Kind of,
A
yeah.
movie that you cannot have other people...
Now, I do think...
Don't talk about Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.
That's literally how people should be attacking the movie itself. Like,
yeah.
don't talk about
I'm
it.
I'm going to turn off the trivia in the future when I watch films like this. But
so you knew exactly what was
going
to happen.
I did, but I think I would have eventually seen where they were going with it. They dropped so many
that
hints.
That actually makes
up
me angry. Because it completely changes your
yeah.
it completely changes your emotions watching that movie.
But I'm glad that the big reveal wasn't, here's the reveal, and that's the end of the movie. I loved that there was another 30 to 40 minutes of it and how he coped with that reveal going forward.
I think you nailed it on the head. It is a coming of age. So what the narrator, which by the way, I've seen this movie six or seven times. I never realized that Edward Norton's character simply does not have a name. He is just the narrator. He realizes that Tyler Durden is the antithesis of who he is. It is him.
Yeah.
It is the alter ego. It is everything that he wishes he wants to be. Then he comes to realize it. And realizes that all of those conversations that he had with Tyler Durden, he was just talking to himself, which is funny because if you go back and watch it the second time, you'll notice one of those little things you'll notice is you'll hardly ever see them talking to each other when there are other people around.
Mm-hmm. Well, like the female love interest, I flipped the page on my notes already, but they're never in the same room together. And Tyler Durden, Brad Pitt's character, is like, don't ever bring me up to her. And he's saying that because if he does, then she'll I think that's where I would have gotten it, when she's kind of reacting to him, kind of like the scene when Brad Pitt's in the basement and he's kind of like shouting instructions to Edward Norton's character.
Right.
And she's kind of like, hey, let's talk about this. You're crazy. You need help. Like, who is this us you keep talking about?
Uh-huh.
Kind of basically. So, but at the reveal in the hotel room, whenever they splice in all the scenes of the things that Brad Pitt has done in the movie, only with Edward Norton doing them, I think that's really brilliant. There was some spots where, like the fight between Lou and Tyler Durden, which is just a hilarious scene when Lou is beating up Brad Pitt and Edward Norton's actually in the background wincing and reacting to some of the body blows and like shots to the face and things like that. This movie, like, so the reason I want to bring this back to old school, like, this is a hilarious movie. It's a movie that makes you think. It's a dark movie. It has a lot of anti-corporate, you know, thoughts and themes and things like that. And the ending to me, like the last, how he survives what he does and gets around that, and like the last scene, it's a little bit, I'm not sure how I feel about that. And I guess I'd have to look into more theory about that. But as far as the movie,
what do you mean you're not sure how you feel about it?
He shot himself in the head and he got up and he was just, you know, like,
yeah,
I'm kind of struggling to wonder, was that like a dream of his or something like that?
Well, but, and here's the thing that I come to terms with. I come to terms with the fact that, okay, he's the narrator. He tells us everything throughout the movie. And then with about 30 minutes left, you realize he's an unreliable narrator. He's an unreliable source of information. And that's what we as movie viewers come to accept from narrators, is he's telling me what's happening. Well, now you realize, okay, well, he was telling me what was happening and he was wrong about everything. So at that point, I think you have to just come to accept the fact that you can't take anything at face value with his character anymore, because he's still telling you the story.
Yeah.
The point of view doesn't change. So does he really shoot himself? Probably not. He just killed that part of him.
And the argument that he has with Brad Pitt at the end, and the conflict that they have, and him throwing himself around, and they cut to the security cam footage of him throwing himself around, like, that to me was perfectly shot and perfectly edited. And the reason I brought up old school is just I found this movie 10 times funnier than old school. This is, there are, the director said that he would classify this as a romantic comedy, which
it's not a romantic comedy.
But like, there are so many elements of funny things, like Meatloaf's character, and just a bunch of the police confession, when he confesses to the police everything that's going to happen, and the chief leaves the room, and then the other three are members of Fight Club, and they're like, Tyler, you're such a genius. Now we have to basically, you know.
That was good, dude.
Like, this movie is very smart, and it's very funny. It goes on a little bit too long, I think. Just 2.5 hours, a little bit too long. But if I were to apply a rating to it,
I think you're giving it a 9 or above.
I'm giving it an 8.7.
8.7?
8.75, I mean.
8.75. Yeah. Okay, that was close.
Yeah, very close.
That's acceptable. It's a very, very rewatchable movie.
Did you know that Rosie O'Donnell got an advanced screening of this movie, and when she had her TV show, said that she hated it, and she spoiled the ending before it was released on her TV show and told her viewers not to go see it?
Why?
And this infuriated everybody, the cast. Like, they all had, like, Brad Pitt has bad blood with Rosie O'Donnell to this day because of this.
Well, the joke's on her, because this movie has been wildly, wildly...
It's fitting that this became a cult
successful
classic.
Yes. All right, so now we added... What movie did we add to the wheel?
Bubble Boy.
We had a conversation about Bubble Boy. We decided it would be a great new addition to the wheel. Go ahead and give it a spin, Matt. Yeah, Matt, your reputation is still alive as a competent movie reviewer, with an 8.75 on Fight Club. As the wheel goes round and round, it is slowing. And what do we got here? We got a sports movie.
Oh, no, not another comedy.
We got a sports movie. It's a comedy. It's Major League.
Cleveland Indians, right? That's
Cleveland Indians, starring Wesley Snipes, Roger Dorn.
Charlie Sheen.
Okay.
Good one.
Wild Thing, right? I know a little bit about
this. Yes, Wild Thing. That is correct.
Mostly from last year's playoff run.
Pedro Serrano, you know the guy who does the Allstate commercials, like You're in Good Hands?
Yeah.
Big black guy? Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's in this movie.
Great. Look forward to it.
Way different character, though.
Yes. Way different character than the Allstate guy. That's Matt Galloway, and that's his movie review. Thank you, sir.
I'm glad I could redeem myself slightly.
He's Matt. I'm Nick with Derek. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Up next, we'll talk to the voice of the Jayhawks, Brian Haney. 5 o'clock hour here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. I am Nick Schwert with Derek Johnson. Thank you so much for hanging out with us today. Getting out a little early. LHS moving up that game against Olathe South. They're going to kick off at 6 o'clock, so pregame coverage will start at 5:45 right here on KLWN with Hank Booth and Matt Llewellyn on the call. But right now, let's talk some KU football with the voice of the Jayhawks, Brian Haney. Brian, KU coming off a bye week, getting ready for this game against Texas Tech tomorrow, and it may sound cliche because we always say it regardless of when it happens about the bye week coming at a great time, but for this Kansas team who looked like they were just so close to kind of breaking through against West Virginia a couple of weeks ago, it really does seem like it was an appropriate time to maybe take some time off and just kind of look inward at yourselves as opposed to continually looking forward at your next opponent.
Yeah, I think so. I think they were ready to have an open week to really do, as you said, some self-analysis and self-diagnosis on maybe tinkering a little bit certain spots. We talked about that last week on the show that you know, there are a few defensive positions, and even in the other two phases of the game where they probably needed to have some open competition, and you just don't have that time to have those types of, you know, clear the deck, clean the slate, see what we got, you know, redefine who's the starter at these particular spots. You can't do that when you've got 2.5-3 days, you know, to get set for the next opponent. But when you have that open week, believe me, they made the most of it. Now, I don't know what the two deep's going to look like come tomorrow at 11. They've kept it really close to the vest. I kind of hinted at that with Coach Beatty on Monday night, and he said, you know, it wouldn't behoove us to announce any changes that may or may not have been made. But I certainly think whether they made changes or not, they dialed up the competition level in that open week practice and really, you know, force some guys to put their feet to the fire and get the most out of what they have at each spot. And there may be a slight tweak or two in terms of who you see where to try and get the best combination working at an optimal level. I firmly believe we can see more out of this defense than what we've seen. And I think Clint Bowen is such an awesome coach that we're really blessed to have. I hate reading the criticism because, folks, he's done more with less in previous seasons than he's ever gotten credit for. And obviously we've not seen some of the results defensively in the tackles for loss or sack category that we had this time a year ago. And it's such a young secondary that early in the year was getting, you know, carved up pretty good. But I think we've seen strides with some of those young defensive backs. Hassan Defense had a great game, I thought, versus West Virginia. And they've been closer with the pass rush to getting all the way to the quarterback and taking him down. Quite frankly, they have gotten to the quarterback, and they haven't completed the play. And I realize close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. We've all heard that 1,000 times. But let's hope this is the week where close turns into complete. And not just completing the play, but completing the game. And you know, there's so many things that we'll talk about in the next 20 minutes about keys for this one. But I think the defense in particular, heading into that bye week, had a lot to prove and a lot to improve. And I, for one, am a believer that we're going to see real progress tomorrow.
Well, it's kind of like baseball, right? When you talk about the sacks on you know, for KU defense, it's like baseball when a guy comes out the gates at the beginning of the year and he's batting 440. Well, he's not going to bat 440 all year long. And eventually he's going to have one of those streaks where all of a sudden he's batting 220. You have regression to the mean. And it's kind of almost the inverse of that with this Kansas defensive front. Like, we know how good they are, and we know what they're capable of. And it seems like we're only a matter of time before seeing some, maybe, I don't know if this is a saying, but progression to the mean. Like, racking up those sacks and getting to the point where we go, okay, this is kind of what we were expecting to see.
And maybe to get progression to the mean, we need some aggression to the mean.
There you go.
And we need to get mean because of our aggression and then get to the other mean, if that makes sense.
I like that.
Have we confused the folks yet?
Probably, but that's okay.
But I agree with you completely. And let me just tell you this. I don't know if I've mentioned this or if I should mention this, but you know, there was a time when Texas Tech wanted to hire Clint Bowen away from the University of Kansas and be their defensive coordinator. They looked long and hard at Clint. And I absolutely believe with the extra week of tinkering and game planning and coming up with some different ways to put his guys in the best possible position to not just get there but finish the play when they do, I think we're going to see a lot more productivity and progression to the mean, as you termed it, in that regard. Now, having said that, Nick Szymanek right now is number two nationally in passing yards per game, and he gets the ball out quick. He clearly had a great second half versus Kansas a year ago when he came on, midway through the third and throws for 271 and four touchdowns. We thought knocking Patrick Mahomes, the number 10 pick in the draft, out of the game was a good thing. And then this guy comes in and lights KU up down the stretch. But I think that, I put my money on Clint Bowen any day when he has a chance to get that extra week of preparation. And he'll do some things, to get Dorrance going, to get Daniel Wise, still going, but even more productive. I've been really impressed with Daniel and his ability to play both at the D tackle spot and defensive end position. And yeah. I think J.J. Holmes has shown some nice things. So I think this is definitely not just this week, but next. These first two games coming off the bye, where hopefully we will start to see that progression toward the mean that you termed. And if we don't, then maybe we drastically overestimated what we thought we had. But I, for one, am still a believer, and I really think if they can get there and knock around Chimenek a little bit, he doesn't turn it over much, only two picks on the year. But maybe they can get a blindside sack that leads to a fumble. Maybe they can get some type of scoop and score, or even just set the offense up with a short field. That's one concept that Coach Beatty talked about, that, yes, the offense is up 7 points per game from where they were at a season ago, but they could be up 14 or 17 points right. a game if the defense was getting more takeaways and setting them up with some shorter fields to go. So maybe this is the week we start to see that tide turn.
Well, I mean, how many times last year were we looking at this team and the defense would make a play, they'd get a turnover, and KU just couldn't capitalize off those turnovers. They couldn't put points on the board. Now we've almost got the opposite of that. The offense is just kind of almost waiting, licking their chops for those turnovers, and it just kind of seems like everybody knows that it's going to come eventually, because if you can get after the quarterback, you're going to force some errant throws. You're going to make the quarterback force some stuff. You're going to get those sack fumbles, and it just does seem like it's only a matter of time before it happens. I don't want to put too much of that pressure directly on those guys up front and Daniel Wise and Dorrance Armstrong, but I mean, maybe I should, right? Because those are your captains. Those are the guys who were welcoming that sort of pressure before the season, and I'm sure they're not backing off of it now.
They aren't, and I think, honestly, there's an edge there that they're sick of hearing about it. They're sick of having to wait, 2 weeks between West Virginia and now to get out there and prove that they can make a difference. And I know this is all just you and I talking, and folks are sick of listening to talk. They want to see action. Well, having talked to Daniel Wise pretty extensively on Tuesday, yeah, he's ready for this fan base to see some action, and they're ready to prove. I asked him, and I couldn't even finish the sentence before he jumped in. I'm like, honestly, shoot straight with me as a captain. How close are we to turning the corner? How close are we to being where we thought we would be, not just in terms of his position group on the D-line, but the defense as a whole? And he's like, it's here, it's now, it's got to come this week. So we'll see. It's a matchup where I think Kansas can do some things defensively to change this game. But at the same time, when you're taking on a team whose scoring average is in the mid-40s and they're off to a terrific start with a quarterback who's even getting some early Heisman votes, not actual Heisman votes, but, those polls that update every few weeks. Clearly, this is not some optimal offensive team you're going up against. But I do think at certain spots Kansas has a chance to see what we thought we were going to see in terms of enforcing its defensive will. And hopefully that comes in the form of getting to the quarterback. But even if it doesn't, Joe Dineen right now is still the nation's number two tackler in tackles per game. He's going to be a busy guy. Tech has not run the ball especially well. We'll see if they can establish it versus Kansas. But obviously their bread and butter is to spread it out, air it out, and throw it around to eight or nine receivers. Will they have Kiki Kuti, though, who's a Biletnikoff Award watch list guy, Tech's 12th in the last 13 years to be on that award watch list, something that Michael Crabtree won twice. So his status goes a long way, because as Chris Level of the Texas Tech Network told me on Monday, he might be the best player on the whole team. So if he's out, and we don't know right now, and they're getting set to board a plane and head up here, if he's out, that's a major loss. But Dylan Cantrell and Cameron Batson and a bunch of other guys would obviously get an uptick in targets and reps and snaps if Kuti can't be on the field. But I do think this. I think if Kansas can control the ball with an effective running game, as we saw these last couple of weeks, and do what they did to open that West Virginia game, that game-opening drive that was 14 plays and 6 or 7 minutes off the clock, 70 rushing yards on that drive from Herbert alone. He had a couple of penalties that made it only a 64-yard drive in total and ultimately just 3 points instead of seven. But the point is, man, they enforced their will in the trenches. They got what they wanted in running the ball, and they kept the West Virginia offense on the sideline for nearly half the quarter while doing it. If KU can do that, if they can keep Šemenek watching more than playing, they got a great shot to pull this upset. But that's just one of many keys, another of which includes takeaways, like you talked about, with Tech being one of the best teams in America in turnover margin right now at plus seven. You got to limit the giveaways, and you got to get a lot more takeaways than what we've seen. And you hear that key every week, no matter who you're talking to, coaches, analysts, wannabes, they'll tell you turnover margin is key. But maybe no week more so than this one when you have two teams at opposite ends of the spectrum in that category. Kansas needs to come up a large distance and pull Texas Tech back from what they've been able to do, because I was there when they hired David Gibbs from Houston to be the defensive coordinator, and Tech was at the end of a miserable stretch where it had been 6 or 7 years with a different defensive coordinator every single year, and they went out to get this guy. And over his first two seasons, there was some doubt amongst the fan base, like we're hearing in other fan bases, including our own, about, man, we're not playing as good as we thought we would. And you just had to trust the process and wait it out, because what they hired him to come in and do was to be what he was at Houston when he was the D.C. and interim head coach there, the guy that preached the rip and strip, the scoop and score, the takeaway game times 10. Everything was about ball hawking, going for the turnover, not to the point where you don't wrap up on the tackle, but they emphasized it like crazy. And it took now 2.5 seasons, but look at where Texas Tech is at right now nationally. 7th in the country, 1st in the Big 12 at plus 7 in the takeaway game. They forced 10 turnovers to start this year, 5 interceptions, 5 fumbles, and they've played 4 games. So they're off to a great start. I think Kansas can get there too, but in order to possibly pull this upset, it needs to happen this week.
We're talking to Brian Haney here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. I want to talk a little bit about the offense, because while we knew that KU had a ton of talent in that backfield, I don't know if anybody saw what happened against West Virginia coming with Khalil Herbert and that historic performance, the 4th most rushing yards in program history. Doug Meacham comes in, bringing in this air raid, and I think that one thing that we take for granted with guys who come in with a pedigree like he does is that you expect that he's going to know exactly what this team's going to look like from day one, and I think that there does take some getting used to your personnel and getting to know these guys and trying to figure out what works best for them. How does Khalil Herbert and this backfield perhaps change what we thought we'd see from Doug Meacham and this offense this year?
Well, I think what you have to credit Doug Meacham is you know, his willingness to adjust and adapt to what he has to work with. And quite frankly, he's got a lot to work with at each spot, admittedly more so than he thought he was going to inherit at the skill positions. He said that on a couple of occasions. But he's not some coach so set in his ways that, by gosh, you know, we're going to snap the ball 92 times and we're going to throw on 55 of them and we're only going to run in this instance. Now, if something's there to be had in a matchup, by golly, one week to the next, they'll change the game plan to exploit whatever upper hand or advantage they can get. And they clearly saw something on the defensive front at West Virginia that they thought they could exploit. And that's why you saw the 14 run plays to open the game. And dang, it worked. And obviously, you're right, nobody saw 291 coming, which was just 3 shy of Nolan Cromwell. Actually, he could have finished at the number 2 rushing total, second only to Tony Sands, that he just got one more carry. He was amazing, was Khalil Herbert. But nobody saw that coming, because while they thought they could establish the run, they didn't think he'd be ripping off the long ones and the long TDs that we saw. And let's not forget about Taylor Martin coming back. Meacham told me before the West Virginia game, well, Martin's our best back. He's our most explosive guy. He's got the biggest ceiling of anybody. And then the other guy goes out and gets 291. So what's that tell you? That tells you you got depth there and you've got a run-blocking scheme that if you're running hard and you're hitting those gaps, you've got a chance to rattle off 5, 6, 7 yards of tote with the way they were blocking up front. I know Tovey committed some penalties, and I know that it hasn't been perfect, but man, ever since Hannon and Tovey gelled with the rest of those guys on the front 5 for Kansas' O-line, we've seen these last couple of weeks some of the best run blocking David Beatty's had in his 3 seasons, and if that continues, it'll keep Kansas in games because of what I mentioned about keeping the opposition on the sideline, but also shortening some of these football games. And it's not that they're wanting to take the air out of the ball entirely. They still want to pass it around and put up great point totals, but if you're now entering into a league in which most of your opponents average north of 40 points a game, the most nightmarish conference in America to be a defensive coordinator. I don't know how these guys sleep, because every week it's a different guy who's on the Davey O'Brien list or the Heisman countdown list and all that stuff, with offenses that spread it out and light up the scoreboard. If you're entering into a situation like that and you've got a great run game that can sustain long drives with 5-6 first downs on a drive, 6-7-8 minutes off the clock, by golly, you'll start taking down snaps and possessions, plays and points from what these other teams can do. Look at Thursday Night Football last night, okay? Bill Belichick didn't have Gronkowski, and yet he knew he could run the ball on Tampa Bay. And I think entering the fourth quarter, Jameis Winston and the offense of the Bucs had all of like 90 yards because they'd hardly possessed the football. And you know, it was much more so of a short passing game, deliberate ground approach, control the clock, keep them off the field. And that's what good teams do. They adjust to accentuate their positives and their biggest strengths, and they try to play keep away if there is a talent disparity in certain matchups. And the best way to play keep away is to control the ball yourself. And right now, that's what Kansas is positioned best to do, and I think it would behoove them greatly if they could do that tomorrow and maybe shorten Texas Tech's number of possessions by a couple. And then if you shorten them by two possessions to begin with because of ball control offense, and you get three or four stops, maybe one of which is a takeaway, suddenly you're not playing this game in the 40s and 50s. Suddenly it's a winnable game in the 30s. And you can absolutely keep pace if that's the case. This Kansas offense averages 32 a game. And as you've astutely pointed out to me, you know, if they could get some takeaways and have a shorter field, there's some more points right there. If they could get off to a faster, more sustained start, there's a chance to up that as well. You know, they've been better in every offensive category, but there's still a significant amount of improvement that I think they're more than capable of getting. And let's hope this is the week we take that elevator up two or three more floors and ultimately all the way to the winner's circle, something this fan base really wants to see.
Hopefully it happens tomorrow, 11 o'clock kickoff inside Memorial Stadium, KU and Texas Tech. Brian Haney will be on the call right here on KLWN. Always appreciate the time, man. Thanks for stopping by once again.
Great talking to you, buddy. I appreciate all the great notes you passed me up in the booth. Nick's one of our right-hand men and coming up with great nuggets during the broadcast. So look forward to seeing you tomorrow and see what you picked out for your press box attire for homecoming. It's always flamboyant and spectacular on that date of the year, so we'll see what you got. And special shout-out to my friends at the Crystal K9. Whenever the Hawks are on the road, Griffey stays with those folks. They do dog grooming, dog obedience, and boarding as well. Crystal K9, right next to the KLWN studios on West 6th. Thanks a lot, Nick.
Yeah, thanks again. I'll be wearing my the same attire I wore to my high school homecoming, so maybe we can all pitch in and do the same thing there.
Seaman Vikings?
That's right. That's right. You got it right.
Okay. So you're going to have the helmet with the horns on it?
Yeah, right. Exactly. So you were a Charger, so I don't know exactly how that's going to work out, but I'm excited to find out tomorrow.
We were the horse kind of Charger, not the bolt kind of Charger, but we'll do our best to represent it. I don't know what David was in Parsons, but I'll make sure he gets the memo too.
All right. Sounds good, man. Look forward to seeing you.
Thanks, Nick.
All right. That is Brian Haney. I am Nick Schwert. This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.